This journey began in a most unusual way. I'm going to talk a little bit about my particular journey, but I'm also going to try to put it in the context of the journeys that many contemporary Western Jews are undergoing now. Mine is not a very unique journey, and I know that there are people in this very building who've made journeys like I have, who've made it in much greater depth than I have, who've gained much more knowledge than I've got, and I want to thank them for encouraging me in the writing of this book and in the reading of the book. I am a classic case of arrested development. I was going to say when I got up here that if I'd had this many people at my bar mitzvah, I really would have been happy. But of course, I wasn't bar mitzvah until I was 42 years old. I did an adult bar mitzvah at a synagogue outside Chicago because I was raised in a classically Reform Jewish family on the south side of Chicago. We celebrated Christmas. We might light a menorah occasionally, but we would mostly do that to bet on which candle lasted the longest. We did some sort of labor Zionist seders every now and then at Pesach if the mood struck us. But we were raised with a kind of classically German assimilated Reform Judaism. And I have a sibling in the audience. I don't want to single her out, but I think it's worth noting from a sociological perspective that I'm the youngest of six children. I'm the only one married to a Jew, and I'm the black sheep of the family. Nobody's comfortable with my wife, you know. It's a big issue that she keeps kosher. So we're still, you know, this is the kind of the context that I came from. I hear the crab cakes were very good at dinner tonight, by the way. So, to put that in context, then my journey into other traditions began very late. But at the time that it began, it didn't strike me as shocking at all. It should have, because by the time I started investigating Buddhism, I had already married an observant Jewish woman who had two children from a previous marriage and who said to me, look, in marrying me, you're committing to a serious Jewish life. You've got to get educated Jewishly. You have to help me raise these children in a Jewish home. You have to help me keep a kosher kitchen. You have to help the kids with their homework. And if you're going to do that, you better learn enough Hebrew to help them at least through first grade. Otherwise, you're not of much use to me. So I did that. I dutifully did those things. I did an adult education program. My wife was a cantor at a Reform synagogue in Denver, Colorado. That's where we met and married. And when we moved back to Chicago, where we're both from, about 10 years ago, she retired from the cantorate. We joined a conservative, really traditional, but formerly conservative shul outside of Chicago. And it was at a point where I really felt proud of myself for finally being a knowledgeable Jew. Because I knew the order of the holidays. I knew the Hebrew alphabet. I was there. So we walk into this conservative shul, and I can't understand a thing that's going on. The entire service is conducted in Hebrew. The bima is set up much like this. I said, why is this guy in the middle facing? Where's he facing? I'm over here. I didn't have, in other words, my knowledge was very elemental, very rudimentary, and I didn't even know it. But the problem was I took this personally, and I said, if this is Judaism, it's not speaking to me. So in that respect, I was kind of, I think, the classic American Jew. I think Canadians are much more polite and much more together. I had a guy today at a Tim Hortons offer to share a bathroom with me. I thought this was so polite it was inappropriate, you know? But I feel like I'm in Canada, I have to be polite. Thank you, thank you. At least in the American sense, we sort of feel like if it doesn't work, let's go shopping for something else, right? The world is available. We live in the midst of untold riches. There's all sorts of spiritual journeys to be had. Let's go explore. And I really wanted to learn to meditate. I felt for a long time that was something that could at least center me spiritually so that everything else could make sense. But I couldn't find, not that I tried as hard as I could, but I couldn't find a teacher of Jewish meditation. And actually a Jewish woman who was a therapist, actually the parent of a kid who went with ours to a Jewish day school, said, you know, I know a Zen center. Maybe you ought to try that. They'll teach you how to meditate. So I went to a Zen center in nearby Evanston, Illinois, and 2 years later, after an intense immersion into Zen Buddhism, I was lay ordained as a Zen Buddhist. Didn't strike me as shocking at all. But of course, my wife was beside herself. To her, this was akin. This was being unfaithful, because she identifies in the depths of her soul as a Jew. I'd made a commitment to her that I would, if not do the same, at least help her and her kids do the same. So what was I doing? And along about that time, something else happened. After 2.5, almost 3 years of intense meditation leading up to lay ordination, which is kind of a big ordeal, I had reached the point, or at least I thought I'd reached the point in Buddhism, where in meditation, where I could sink beneath all the levels of conscious thought, kind of like a bathysphere going down. You know, at first you're sitting, and the grocery lists are going through your head, and that mean thing somebody said to you in the office. And pretty soon they're not going by as fast, and pretty soon they just stop. And I could be patient enough and sit long enough so that more than 50% of the time that could happen. And one day, I was doing that, and the essence of my Jewishness announced itself to me. Supposedly, you know, Zen Buddhism teaches you that there really is no such thing as the self, with a small s. There's a large s. But much of our suffering, which Buddhism aims to end, much of our suffering is caused by the stories we tell ourselves about how we're the center of the universe and nobody appreciates that fact. And if we can only get beyond it, we'll stop suffering and we'll be able to help other people end theirs. So I thought I had reached this level where really myself as a distinct entity didn't exist. And that's when the Jewishness of my essence chose to announce itself to me. And I thought, well, that's kind of a freak. I'm going to come back tomorrow and see if that happens again. I think it's happening because my wife is mad at me. I don't think it's, you know, my neshama talking to me. I think it's my id, you know? I think it's my wife. But it kept happening. And so I spoke to the Zen teacher and said, I can't come back anymore. She said, I understand. This happens a lot. And in fact, it does. In fact, a lot of Jews who go deeply exploring other traditions come back. And they come back renewed, refreshed, invigorated, inspired to find what they now know exists in Judaism, or now sense exists in Judaism. I think Jews for Judaism is very good at that work, and I think Rabbi Skobach and his wife Hashi, who taught a meditation class at my house and did a wonderful job, I think they deeply recognize that Jews can be helped to learn this. I certainly learned it, and I said to Rabbi Tatz in the book, you know, it may not be such a good thing in the eyes of many Jews that I did this, but I think it made me a better Jew in the end. To which he replied in the book, well, you know, an amnesiac might be cured by a blow to the head, but that doesn't mean you're going to start prescribing blows to the head for amnesiacs, does it? There's got to be a better way. I want to read to you one thing from the book, which is the description of my failed PR move, which was to take my wife to the Zen Center and show her how normal it really was. How really what goes on there is not something that's threatening. We're not shaving our heads and banging tambourines in airports, you know? We're not collecting change on street corners. We're people who are trying to deepen ourselves spiritually. And I had a teacher who I felt was wonderful at doing that. And so I said, you know what? I said to my teacher, can I bring my wife? And my teacher said, sure, bring her. But the teacher, the Zen priest at the Zen Center, also happens to be a Jungian therapist. I thought, what better? You know, we can get some psychoanalysis and analysis into the bargain. We can not only deepen ourselves, but my wife will see that she's crazy. So this is what happened. I take my wife to the Zen Center. After a little instruction and discussion, we begin sitting in meditation together. Then my wife wants to come. The priest, dressed in clothes, conservative clothes that say, hi, I'm a Jungian therapist, greets my wife and shows her the meditation hall, the kitchen, the small library, and the outdoor garden. She explains that people who come to the Zen Center are people from diverse religious backgrounds and that many of these people are still active in those religions. She even has a student who for more than 2 decades was a Carmelite nun. My wife looks around and she says, why are there statues everywhere? Well, my meditation teacher says, the statues of the Buddha are there as the reminders of the essence of what we call Buddha nature. They represent a certain kind of centered, aware, solid presence that we each have and can cultivate within ourselves. In my religion, my wife says acidly, we call that idol worship. It's strictly forbidden. Well, my teacher begins, oh, my wife interrupts, and by the way, it's my husband's religion too. And it's the religion we're raising our children in, just so there's no confusion. I understand, the meditation teacher says. I begin staring intently at my shoes. So why do you want to get my husband to practice this entirely different religion? My wife asked. What's in it for you? Is it kind of like saving souls? He came to me seeking instruction in meditation, the teacher says evenly. I can see that it's something that's very important to him and that might benefit him. And when someone seeks instruction from me, I first try to discern whether they're serious about it. I can see that he is, and it's not in my nature or my job description, if you choose to look at it that way, to refuse people instruction in what I've been trained to teach them. I hear there's a lot of bowing in Buddhism, my wife says. Do you bow? Yes, there is bowing, my teacher says. What do you bow to? It depends on what part of a service we're in. Oh, my wife interrupts. So it's not just meditating, it's a regular religion with services and everything. Well, my teacher says, it's true that Buddhism is a religion. And so what do you bow to again? We may bow across the meditation hall to each other after a sitting, or we may bow to the Buddha statue at the head of the hall. If that's not idol worship, I don't know what is, my wife fairly spits. But the statue does not represent a deity. There's no worship per se in Buddhism. You can call it whatever you want, my wife says. We bow to the statue of the Buddha because we're recognizing and honoring Buddha nature. I think I've seen enough, my wife says. Come on, let's go. My teacher regards my wife evenly for a second. My wife is breathing hard. Her nostrils are dilated. She's seething with revulsion and anger. The teacher tries once more. This is something he may pursue, though, the teacher says. It may be important for him. No, I don't think so, my wife says. You get the idea. I actually read that part at one of the talks I gave, and in the question and answer afterwards, somebody said, so you're not still married, are you? I said, not only are we still married, my wife is one of my heroes. I thought that was an incredibly brave, forthright, not entirely diplomatic, but totally to the point thing to do. The thing that bothers me, let me hold off on that for a second. Let me just say, as a result of this repeated experience of sitting in meditation and recognizing on a deep level that I was Jewish, and as a result of my wife's insistence that what I was doing was fundamentally untrue, not just to her, but to all units of Jewish identity, the self, the family, the marriage, the community, I felt clear that I would not be going back to the Zen Center anymore. As a result of that, I did, as I said, an adult bar mitzvah. I began to learn Hebrew. I spent 10 days at the conservative yeshiva in Jerusalem. I'm trying to earn a master's in Jewish studies. I'm trying in small steps to get literate. But the best thing that happened in all this process was that my wife went to some Orthodox rabbis that run a Torah learning center very near my house. One of them was South African, and one of them is American. The American gentleman was the one that's really taught our children and done wonderful work with our family. And she went to him and said, Rabbi Karsh, you've got to help me stop him. You've got to help me stop my husband. He said, what is he doing? She said, he's turning into a Buddhist. He's going to a Zen center and learning how to meditate. Rabbi Karsh, an Orthodox rabbi, said, And what do you want help with again? She said, this is wrong. You have to help me stop him. She said, Rabbi Karsh, to her astonishment, said, no, you don't understand. He's engaged in a spiritual search. Let him go. This is wonderful, actually, because he's going to learn a great deal and he's going to come back. Sometimes, a tugboat takes a while to turn around. The big ships, if they're deep in the water, it'll take a while, but he'll come back. You mustn't interrupt this. If you do, spiritually, you don't know what's going to happen, so let him go. That was one thing that happened. The other that happened with the South African rabbi, Zev Khan, was that he said, I know a rabbi from South Africa. Maybe you've heard of him, Rabbi Akiva Tatz. I said, no. Sorry. And he said, he's wanted to correspond with a Jew drawn to Buddhism. He hears that this is a real phenomenon, but he doesn't know anybody. He wants to find out why this is happening. Could you maybe, I'll give you his email address, could you write to him and tell him some of the obstacles for you to being an observant Jew? I said, sure. That began a correspondence that was very intense and lasted over a year, and the result of that correspondence is the book. Rabbi Tatz, in a way that only a master can do, made clear his deep disdain for what I did and his deep compassion for why I did it. And he taught me brilliantly without ever judging me. Or if he did judge me, it didn't occur in a way that I felt was going to obstruct my growth as a Jew. I've learned a lot, and I've learned, among other things, that the Talmud says that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred between Jews. one thing that I feel is a great obstacle to Jewish learning is sectarian strife between the various denominations of Judaism. I think the knowledge is there for all Jews to delve into. I think the knowledge and the dogma, in contravention to what most people believe, rather than being an obstacle to spiritual growth, is actually the doorway to spiritual growth. Learning the choreography must, however, be accompanied by hearing the music. The Shema is the central prayer, and it's about hearing. And the brain, our brain, if I've learned anything in Buddhism, is that the brain makes a great deal of noise. The brain is a filter. We can't possibly hear or take in or absorb all the stimuli that are coming at us, because if we did, we'd drop dead in an instant. And that's true of the spiritual realm as well as of many other realms. Meditation helps open the filter to the spiritual realm. It helps open the filter to prayer, to understanding what prayer really is. Excuse me for a moment. And that's why I think for Jews to learn to meditate, which I think is the bedrock experience that underlies prayer, is not a bad thing. It's not something all Jews need to do. And let me hasten to say that I don't think my experience gives me the right to tell anybody what to do. I can only share with you my experience and hope that you'll learn from it. My experience has been that meditation is at its root a Jewish experience. There are stories of meditation all through the Torah and all through the Tanakh. There is a wonderful tradition of Jewish meditation, and it is nothing but preparation for prayer. If that is the worst thing that we do as Jews, then that's not so bad. I'd like to just finish by reading an exchange that I had with Rabbi Tatz about my journey through Buddhism and about what it means for Judaism in general. I said, "Dear Akiva, the Jew who levels claims of inaccessibility may be a lot like me, experiencing that inaccessibility despite living an active Jewish life, pursuing more Jewish education, raising Jewish children. The real question is, exactly what is it about Judaism that is sending Jews in other directions? Although Buddhism is a venerable tradition, you have said that at best it can be seen as preparation for a life of Torah. My response to this is ironic but truthful. In my experience, Buddhism does a better job of preparing one to live a Jewish life than does Judaism." I'll quote to you from Rabbi Tatz's response. "Dear David, that is exile. That is how far the Western Jew has become estranged from the real and proper engagement of his mind and heart. A core issue here is lack of genuine Jewish education, and far worse, non-authentic Jewish education, to the point where what is known of Judaism could hardly be more wrong. The modern Jew who is the victim of such education may come to reject the version of Judaism that he knows, not surprisingly given his distorted picture, in favor of something that appears beautiful, not beginning to realize that what he has chosen is no more than a fragment of the real Judaism he's not begun to discover." Rabbi Tatz and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on all things, but in that we agree. And I think that's where I'm going to end my comments. So before I entirely end it, I just want to say that I hope that each of you who want to explore spiritually and who are Jewish will consider doing so in a Jewish context, because I've learned the hard way that though there are many ways up a mountain, there are also many Jewish ways up that particular mountain, and that they all deserve exploration and are crying out to be explored. And you don't have to take the scenic detours. Certainly there are those who will and do, and they're not to be judged. But there are riches waiting for all of us, crying to us not only from the books, but from the experiences and the teachers that are in our midst, amongst whom I count Rabbi Tatz, gratefully. Thank you very much.
Just a request, if anyone here has a flash camera, not to use it until later on tonight. Thank you very much.
first of all like to thank David for that excellent presentation and for coming all the way to be part of this this meeting, this opportunity to share ideas. I'd like to thank all the rabbis involved, a number of them, the Metzger Shul, and all of you for coming to help us engage in this ongoing dialogue. It should be obvious to you that David has come a long way. If only he could learn to speak with the right accent. Then we will have completed the job. I'm not really sure what is of major interest to you. My own personal story, perhaps we can discuss a little later if it is really relevant. I was not brought up religious, I was brought up normal. And I got more, perhaps, involved during my years after high school and during my years at medical school for various reasons in South Africa. And if you have an interest in my personal journey, perhaps we can talk about that afterwards. But in terms of the Jewish-Buddhist dialogue, there are many things that I learned from David as we went through our communication, and of course, a lot of it we try to put into the book, which you can read. I'm sure you're aware that according to very deep Kabbalistic teachings, if you buy two copies, you will understand it really deeply. But if you buy three, it'll be... But one of the things that struck me that I must say I gained a much clearer understanding of in terms of where Judaism stands with respect to Buddhism and perhaps almost every, if not every other, spiritual path on earth was brought home to me when David began speaking to me about some of the issues. And I had the opportunity in London when my teacher, one of the great rabbinic authorities in this generation, visited us during this time we were writing the book together. And I shared with him some of the things I'd learned about Buddhism and asked him some questions. A remarkable idea became very clear to me that I think is at the heart of Jewish thinking. And I'd like to try to share it with you in the time that we have, but if you have an interest in this, we can explore it further. Concentrate with me and let's take a journey through some of Jewish thinking, Jewish history, a little bit of Kabbalistic insight perhaps, and see if we can develop it together. If you took an educated Westerner, right, any of you, or you walked out into the street and you took someone up the street, Jewish or non-Jewish, and you asked him what Abraham brought to the world, what is the main Jewish contribution to world history? What did Abraham Avinu, Abraham, what did he bring to the world? I think 99% of people would say that word, namely, monotheism. And I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong, and I'd like to show you why and try to develop together a more sophisticated or more mature understanding of the central concept of Judaism. I'd like to try to show you that that was not his novel idea, that it was already richly known, and that he contributed something that is far more radical and something that no one besides us, I think, has assimilated into their path. First of all, let's begin the journey. Let's first of all ask the question, is it conceivable that the world in that phase of its history had already forgotten about one God? Okay, let's try again. First of all, you know that according to Torah chronology, he lived very close to the beginning of history. Right? In which year was Avram born, do you know? 1948, only less than 2,000 years after the beginning of history, of human history. Not only that, but Noah was still alive. Right? Noah, who had survived the flood, was still alive. In fact, according to our tradition, Abraham was 58 years old when Noah died. Which means that he knew him, and there's no question that that Noah, who had survived the flood by direct divine command, had certainly not forgotten about God. He was walking the earth teaching about Hashem, about one God. His son, Shem, and together with Ava, Shem and Ava, were running a yeshiva. They were running a yeshiva teaching Torah at the highest level. They were certainly teaching the Torah of one God. First of all, we have clear tradition that they were teaching that. Secondly, we have a medrash that says that when Rebecca was pregnant, you remember that she suffered some sort of tension dichotomy in her pregnancy. The pregnancy seemed to respond when she went past the place of spiritual greatness. It seemed to respond when she went past the place that appealed to the earthy, the physical. She was distressed by this tension. She went to ask the great Shem, the great prophet, son of Noah, what was the meaning of this tension? And he said to her, you have twins, Yaakov and Esav, and he predicted their destiny. You see that the man running this great yeshiva was on a prophetic level. He was teaching authentic Torah at a prophetic level. Another example, you see that when Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, when he was on his way to live in Laban's house, for 14 years he stopped off in the yeshiva Shem Ve'er and he studied there. It must have been a yeshiva teaching at the highest level. One interesting question is, why did he need to study? What did he learn there that he had not already learned in the homes of his father and grandfather? Clearly knowledge of God. And it is very hard to support the thesis that Abraham came to the world and taught people about one God. Yes, it's true that he broke the idols and he railed against idolatry. But if we spend just a moment looking into the Kabbalistic tradition, we see that idolatry does not mean a detachment or forgetting about God. Let's just spend a moment to try and establish that. Are we allowed to talk a little Kabbalistic thinking? You know, what is the meaning of idolatry? The common Western notion is that idolatry means the worship of idols. It means a person takes a piece of wood, he carves that wood into the shape of some sort of totem or fetish, and then he bows down to it, asserting that it made him. The person who does that does not have a religious problem. He has a psychiatric problem. Right? It's immature and completely superficial to think that idolatry is that sort of thing. The graven images are only representations of something much deeper. You see that in many ways. First of all, it's just not cogent to think that intelligent people could worship physical objects as if they have creative power. Secondly, you see that the Torah's greatest prohibition is idolatry. The second of all the commandments, the first of all the negative commandments. It's going to be a long night. Try again. The first of all negative commandments, which Kabbalistically means contains all the rest, is the prohibition of idolatry. If idolatry is no more than the worship of empty fetishes, figments of some South Sea Islander's imagination, it would not be the major prohibition of the Torah. If that were the case, if that was all it was, then the Torah should have 613 commandments, and the 614th should be, thou shalt not be foolish. But obviously it's something much deeper than that. To put the question in a more sophisticated way, this is the way our sages put it. You know that all the names of idols in the Torah are the same names as divine names. You know that? Kikol Elohei Ha'amim Elilim, because all the gods of the nations are false gods. Elohei Ha'amim, that's the same name we use for God. It's true we never use the name of essence, the four-letter name of essence that we never pronounce. That's never used in this context. But all the other names that are given to idolatry are the same words that are used in the divine context. And Hebrew is a description of essence. Right? If that name is a divine name, and it's also used as a name of an idolatrous focus, there has to be something incredibly deep and real about that idolatrous reality. And the correct concept is this. Idolatry does not mean the worship of some graven image or some star or zodiac as if it has divine power. The concept is more like this. The Kabbalists say that there are many interlocking worlds. Again, this is not particularly secret stuff. You can read it in many sources. There are many devolving worlds, each one interlocking with the one beneath it. Each one bringing out the one beneath it, which is a more concrete, a more tangible level, close to the physical, until finally the end of all the worlds is the one we inhabit. You can't go lower than this, because this is a world which is completely finite. Things in this world have a particular measure. You can't freeze them more than that. Technically speaking, there is one world beyond this. That's the world of the dark forces. That's another discussion. But in terms of the devolution of worlds, this is the lowest. The principle is that each world, now stay with me, each world brings out one beneath it and has the purpose of connecting all that comes above it to all that is below. Each world in this system has something in common with the world above and a translation mechanism and something in common with the world beneath it. And that's the principle, a lot to talk about here. Let's focus for a moment on one particular layer in this system, the second last of the worlds. The second last of all these worlds, and I'm simplifying it, just skipping much here, just for the trying to get the central idea across. The second last layer in these layers is the world that's known as the world of the zodiac, what's called the mazalot. Mazal in Hebrew means to flow, right? It does not mean luck. People think mazal means luck. That's exactly the opposite of what it means. In Hebrew, nozel means a liquid. Mazal means the world that brings down the flow of energy from the higher worlds, translates the oneness that is manifest above into the differentiated particulate expression in this world. In an image that is dangerous, but one is allowed to use. The Kabbalists say that the higher worlds are like a basin of water, a bath of water, in which all the water is indiscernible, it's one. But in the bottom of the basin, if you picture the ceiling as being the bottom of those worlds, there are holes. And the holes bring down the channels. Each, what is called in Kabbalistic writings, the tzinorot, each channel, each pipeline, brings down a specific and finite dispensation that results in a particular object or event in this world. Mazal means the place of flow. Just as an aside, by the way, what do you mean when you say mazal tov? What do you mean? What do you mean as a Jew when you say, you mean good luck? Is that what you mean? That is a pagan travesty of the first order. If someone is getting married and you say mazal tov and you mean good luck, you know, you may your marriage turn out like three cherries in a row. You know, that's what I hope you're... A Jew has no business. It's not what you mean. What you mean is, may this marriage be affected, influenced by an auspicious flow of divine energy from a hidden layer into your life. It's the opposite of luck. Luck means that which is detached from any meaningful control dimension. That's the concept. Now, idolatry is this. When a person looks up to the source of those channels, he's looking correctly. He's looking to the source of where the energy comes from. The correct method is to look beyond the channels to the source of oneness. That's the Jewish role. Idolatry is the process of looking up at the channels and stopping there. What's the motivation? The motivation is the person's concern to look only to the source of what he needs. If you want a crude analogy, the departmental heads. In other words, he's interested in the fellow who runs the department because he supplies the goods. In the very memorable analogy of one of my great teachers, he said in a very, very slick analogy, he said, idolatry is like a person who walks into a department store and he sees a camera behind the counter that costs 1,500, he only has 150. He calls over the fellow behind the counter and he says to him, I'll slip you 150, you slip me the camera. He's only interested in who runs the department. He's not interested in who owns the overall store. Because he doesn't deal with me directly, he doesn't deliver the goods. That is exactly the opposite of Judaism. We are not looking to the individual channel. The Greeks had a god of everything. God of love, god of war, god of fertility, god of peace. No god created the world because he's irrelevant to me. The Jewish path is you walk into the department store and you go and see the owner, you tell him you want to buy it. That is the way we function. Our process is looking through the channels to the source. We are allergic to the concept of intermediaries. Do you know there are some Jewish families that do not sing Shalom Aleichem on Friday night? Do you know why? Because in the second verse of that song you say, Baruchuni l'shalom, bless me in peace to the angels. And you may make the mistake of thinking that this angel has some independent decision-making power. For that reason, the people who don't sing it. Because you have to understand that a channel is only an intermediary, and you look beyond the intermediary, the foolishness of idolatry is imagining that the channel, although it's real, has independence. Uh-oh, are we together? In other words, in summary, an idolater has not forgotten about God. He just doesn't relate to him. He's interested only in who delivers the goods, because what he's really interested in is himself. Now, that's the full inversion. So let's go back to our main theme. Abraham comes on the scene, and he fights against idolatry, meaning that what's relevant here is the oneness behind the scenes. But people had not forgotten about God. There are many other questions you could ask here. We could spend perhaps all night doing that. But let me pick out what I think is the solution to the question, the answer to the question of what it is that he brought to the world. But we need to concentrate here because there are unfamiliar ideas. Here's the history of this problem. And here's the Jewish solution, and here's the non-Jewish response, in general. Adam and Eve united when they sinned, what happened was this. Previous to the sin, the soul and the body were completely united. That means the body was an incandescent, it was a vessel that allowed the luminescence of the soul of the neshama to shine through. The way this is put in our deep sources is that man was clothed in garments of light. What's called kosmos or he wore garments of light. What does it mean to wear a garment of light? It means that the garment doesn't hide, it reveals. The garment we're talking about was the body. They wore no clothes, right? They wore no clothes. Man and woman wore no clothes originally because there was no sense of shame. What generates shame? Why do you feel ashamed with no clothes on? The reason you feel ashamed is because you're aware that you have an inner angelic being that is housed in an outer animal body. It's the schism between those, the dichotomy between those elements that causes shame. There's a shame in having an angelic, transcendent, infinite inner being represented in a body that is exactly in common with an animal. The response to that is to cover the body. There are two responses, of course. The incorrect response is to cover the nakedness to hide the shame. The correct response, which is exactly a Jewish response, is to hide the body in a way that demonstrates its dignity. There's a tension here. You know that the Kabbalists say that Aleph is always the letter of the soul. It's the only silent letter in the Hebrew alphabet. You know that the Hebrew says everything. Aleph is the letter of the soul. Aleph in Hebrew means to teach, to raise spiritually. Aleph is the highest number. Aluf is the highest. Many thinkers say that in the devolution of languages from Hebrew, the word elephant, aluf, are distant derivatives of the original Hebrew root. The aleph is always the letter of spirituality. It means one. It indicates the whole spiritual world. You know how an aleph looks? 10 Kabbalistic dimensions coming down from above. 10 reflected in this world, and the letter Vav joining them, the letter of conjunction. 10, 10, and 6, 26, the divine name. The Aleph says the whole story is in the Aleph. And after that, the next three letters in the alphabet are Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Beged, a garment. First the soul, and then the next three letters, as you come down into the world, spell the vessel that covers that garment. And of course, it's no accident that the word Beged in Hebrew means a garment and treachery. The same word, because a garment, you know the old English word for a traitor? It's a turncoat. Right? Because the garment reveals dignity. When a king wears royal garments, it hides the king, but it shows that he's royal. Right? That's the tension here. But that was not necessary before the sin. The response. You know what the Kabbalists say, an amazing thing. Man was clothed before the sin in Aleph Vav Resh, light, or. And after the sin, he became clothed in Ayin Vav Resh, also pronounced or. You know that there's a Kabbalistic principle that in Hebrew, whenever an Aleph becomes an Ayin, it represents a transition from spiritual to physical, right? A falling into the physical. First he was clothed in light, and then he became clothed in or skin. But if you know in Hebrew, you know that the word Ayin Vav Resh, which spells skin, literally spells Iver, blind. First he was clothed in light, meaning in that which reveals, and now he's clothed in a hide. Why is it called a hide, incidentally? Why is it called a hide? Before it was that which revealed, now it's that which hides. That was the situation. So here you have this being who has a body. One Kabbalistic master once said that if you looked at Adam, you saw only the soul. The voltage was so intense, all you saw was the soul shining through. If you look very carefully, you can make out the wisp of a body. Today, when you look at a person, all you see is the body. And if you look very carefully, you can make out a very faint glow of spiritual sensitivity. But it's exact inverse of what it was. You know, there's a very humiliating way to put this, and we might as well share it. You know, Rabbi Dessner says that when man was created initially, the inversion has been so complete, it's utterly humiliating. You know that when man was created originally, his first person consciousness was spirit. And his second person, the second person voice, was temptation. That's why the serpent depicts it as, the Torah depicts it as a serpent. That means the I was all spiritual. And the outside voice, the you, was temptation. But now after the sin, the first person voice is always physical. Always physical. When you have something delicious and tempting, what does your inner voice say? I'd like to taste that. And how does your conscience speak? No, you shouldn't. Isn't that humiliating? That's how we construct it now. And usually, by the way, the tone of voice is not equal either. It's I'd like to taste that. And the conscience is, excuse me, not you. The Talmud says that the lower self is first like a passerby in the street, and then it's like a guest at the door, a beggar at the door, there's like a guest, and then if you're lucky, you remain the guest. And can I put it one more way? My great teacher in Jerusalem once said this: what's the right way to rob a bank? Walk in with a motorcycle helmet and a kosher is not for a Jewish boy. The way to rob a bank is you make an appointment with the manager, you walk into his office, you lock the door behind you, you put a sock in his mouth, you put him in his closet, lock the closet, you sit in his desk and you run the bank. That's the sensible way. That's the sensible way to run a bank. That's how we have been hijacked by our lower selves. Yeah, we think of it in the first person. That's foreign to the ideal human condition. Now, let's take one more. Are we together? One more step. What was the human response to this problem? What was the human response to being locked into the body and to being hijacked and taken over and imprisoned in a body? It seems to me, some of you may correct me, it seems to me that the universal human response has been that the body needs to be controlled. The body's the problem. It needs to be beaten down and disciplined. And to the best of my knowledge, every spiritual path from that day on has been a pathway of celibacy, asceticism, beating down of the body and bringing it under control. Think about it for a moment. Christianity, for example. Christianity is fraught with guilt when it comes to intimacy and functions of the body. In Christianity, if you want to transcend, you become a monk or a nun. Muslims, in Islam, you may not own alcohol, not drink, own alcohol. I know, because when I went to Israel for the first year, just before Pesach, I had some very expensive whiskey. So I didn't want to pour out the whiskey, so I went down to Abu Ghosh, and I found an Arab on the street, and I asked him if he'd be kind enough to buy my whiskey. I knew he wasn't allowed to drink it. I told him, buy the whiskey, I'll come back 8 days from now, I'll buy it back. He said he'd love to buy the whiskey, he's not allowed to own whiskey. I had to go down to a Christian moshav where they tried to convert me to Christianity. I had to pour the whiskey out. You know that alcohol, which represents the perfect representation of tension between bringing the mind down into the body or used sensitively to elevate and expand consciousness, is a massive problem in the world around us. A massive problem. I don't think there's a Western country in which there's not a legal age of drinking, right? Or buying alcohol. In Judaism, can you imagine such a thing? A baby's 8 days old and putting wine in his mouth. You have to understand this. In Buddhism, as David has told me, there's a path of marriage. But even those who marry, there's a path called the householder's path. But even there, there's a path of celibacy and frequent retreats into asceticism and celibacy. Hinduism teaches that the engagement of the body is secondary. Right? If you could get to that level without it, it would be primary. Wherever you look. In England, there was a very enlightened man called Krishnamurti. You know about him? A very, very enlightened teacher. He came to England, not alive anymore. He was a very enlightened teacher, and he taught that marriage is evil. But in other words, the problem was that the body has now taken over, and to free the soul, the response is you beat it down. And Abraham came on the scene, and he said, the body's not the problem, the body's the solution. And Judaism became a path that engages the body to elevate it to sanctity. And the rest of the world said to him, you're crazy. When you allow the body to speak, if you pander to the body, you give it its pleasure, and you indulge the pleasures of the body, you will sink the mind down into that quicksand. And he said the function that we have to do now, what we have to do now, we have to put the mind into the body and elevate the physicality of the body to sanctity. And the reason is because you're postulating here a schizoid world. You're postulating a world that has now been torn apart. And our function is to stitch it together. Because the deepest principle of Judaism is Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And you can't live Jewishly in a world that is split asunder. Do you know what the Midrash says? The Midrash says we have a young sister. Right? We have a verse in Shir HaShirim. Achot Lanu Ketana. We have a young sister. The Midrash says, who's our young sister? Abraham. Why? Because the word Achot in Hebrew, meaning brother or sister, means to reconnect, to connect. Ach means brothers or people who are connected. Right? Achot means someone. The word La'achen in Hebrew means to stitch together. Why is he called our young sister? Because he stitched together the torn world. Which torn world? The world of physicality and earthiness and sensuality and the world of sanctity. And the Jewish path teaches that if you want to reach sanctity, you elevate your body. Elevating your mind is not the problem. The mind's already elevated. Shem and Eva were teaching, they were sitting on a mountaintop teaching ascetic Torah. When you went to that yeshiva, you didn't sleep. And Abraham came on the scene and he said, what marks you off as holy is how you, what the function of your fingers and toes. It's how you eat your bread and drink your wine. All of Judaism is a connecting of the lower with the higher. This is not the environment to go into it, but the Khuzari says that intimacy in marriage, many others say that intimacy in marriage
is the pinnacle of this experience. It's potentially the most fraught with danger, that which is potentially able to bring a person completely down into the animal, and it's the holiest function a person can engage in. The Kuzari says it's absurd. It's an example of spiritual paradox, but that's the Jewish function. You know that wine, the Gaon of Vilna says that wine is an avenue into the secret world, because wine is that single physical substance that obeys the rules of the spiritual. And that's why in Judaism, we take wine at every junction between spiritual and physical. Both people are getting married, when physical bodies will engage in a relationship that we want to reach sanctity, a cup of wine is held. Bris milah, circumcision, we're taking the earthiness of the body and giving it the ability to transcend, we take a cup of wine. Shabbos, when the week transcends into the elevation of Shabbos, we take a cup of wine. In every moment of connection, of course, Saturday night is the pinnacle of that experience. When you come down into the week to elevate the week for our higher Shabbos next week, we take a cup of wine. The Gaon of Vilna says wine is that substance, we use it, because it's uniquely that substance which gives you access to the spiritual world. All other physical things get worse with time. All physical things, spiritual things like wisdom, get better with time. Physical things always get worse with time. Wine is that physical substance which gets better with time. It's an avenue of access into the spiritual world. The whole of Judaism, wherever you look, is the remarkable attempt to engage the body and reunite it in an elevated fashion with the soul. The word Avraham, but you could go on and on about this. Maybe I will. But I'll speak just for a couple of minutes and we'll stop for questions. What activity am I talking about? I've been talking about one subject tonight, and it's called mitzvahs. Mitzvot. Do you know what a mitzvah is? A mitzvah is a physical action that expresses sanctity. The word mitzvah, do you know what it really means? It does not mean commandment. If you know any Hebrew, you know that the right word for commandment is tzivui. The word mitzvah is something else. It contains the connotation of commandment, but it has another overlay. The word mitzvah in Hebrew means to connect. But savtachada means in one bond. Sevet means a crew, people who operate together. Mitzvah means an action that the animal body does that brings in the divine soul into that action. You know, the Torah says in the beginning, Eile told us the Shemayim Baaretz, Vehibaram. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth in their being created. Listen carefully. Heavens and earth, this dichotomous construction, in their being created. The word Hibaram spells the same letters as Avraham, Abraham. He's the one who brought together the split between heaven and earth. And the number of Avraham is 248. The exact number of positive commandments in the Torah. He's the one who brings in the sanctity of his body an expression of the divine. And that, of course, any Jew understands what circumcision is, understands that that's exactly the message. There are many places you see this. I'll just give you two more examples, if I may. One, the Torah says, the Gemara says, the Talmud says, that anybody who learns Torah and does not practice mitzvot in the world, that Torah is not Torah. Why not? If I engage that mystical wisdom and I understand it all, and I fail to act in accordance with it in the world, I don't fulfill it. Why is it not Torah? It's still wisdom. The answer is that Jewish Torah is that which is conditional upon being brought into action. One more example. The Talmud says that if a person grows up to be a person who knows Torah but does not fulfill it in the world, does not practice it with his hands and feet, doesn't live it in his body, it's better that his mother's afterbirth should have covered his face and smothered him at birth. That's what it says. Now that is a very peculiar expression. Why exactly that? Again, amazing idea here. What exactly is the concept of a person, a child, dying at the point of birth? What does that mean? And the answer is this. The Talmud says that when a child is in the womb, it learns the whole Torah. Jew or non-Jew, incidentally. A person in the womb learns the whole Torah. He knows the whole spiritual world. He sees from one end of the world to the other. He knows his own destiny, his own role, his own marital partner. He knows the whole cosmic structure. And as he's born, at the moment of birth, an angel strikes him on the mouth and he forgets the whole Torah. He's born as an unlearned child who knows nothing, who has to fight his whole life to get back to the knowledge that he once had for free. Long and complicated story, a lot to talk about. But the concept is this. A person who grows up in the world and has not fulfilled Torah with his body, the perfect moment for such a person to die is at the moment of birth. Because if what he's looking for is Torah wisdom, he'll never have it as good as he had it in the womb, because then he had it all. The point of being born is not to get back to that Torah knowledge. It's to get back to it and practice it in the world. Yeah? And That's the object. The object is to live in a body that is potentially fallen, lecherous, smelly, contains excrement given to disintegration, and to make that holy. The Kabbalistic teaching is that existence in the next world is the existence of the body. That's why one of the 13 fundamentals of Jewish teaching is the resurrection of the body. It's not incidental. It's because the body and the soul... Can I give you one more example? There's one more. I promise. One more. Body and soul form an integrated unit that is called life. One without the other is irrelevant. And here's the final example. The Talmud says that when Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the author of the Mishnah, was arguing with his friend Antoninus, the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, who was a very great man spiritually, they used to debate spiritual matters. On one occasion, Antoninus said to him, you have to understand, this comes from a Roman. That's from that perspective, right? He said to him, I will show you that when you die, you can exempt yourself from punishment. How? Because when you die, dying means separation of soul and body, right? That's the definition in Torah of death. Death doesn't mean that the soul disappears. The soul is eternal. Dying means that the two are distracted one from the other. So when the two are separated in death, you'll be able to exempt yourself from punishment. Because when God comes to punish the body will say, what do you want from me? I'm just a lump of clay. If it hadn't been from the animating power of the soul, I never would have sinned. Then when God tries to punish the soul will say, what do you want from me? I'm floating there like a bird. If it hadn't been for the earthiness of the body, I never would have sinned. Nice try, huh? So Rabbi said, I'll answer you as follows. Listen to this beautiful illustration. He said to him, there once was a king who had an orchard. And he had beautiful ripe fruit in his orchard. And he took two guards to guard the orchard. One was a blind man and one was a lame man. The two guards began guarding, and the lame man said to the blind man, I see very delicious fruit. But he couldn't walk and the other one couldn't see. So the lame man climbed on the shoulders of the blind man. And using his ability to walk and his ability to see, they stole all the fruit and ate it. Sometime later, when they were lying under the trees full of fruit, the king arrived in his orchard, found all the fruit gone. So he walked up to the lame man, was about to beat him in punishment. The lame man said, Your Majesty, couldn't have been me. I couldn't walk. If it hadn't been for his legs, we never could have done this. So then he went over to the blind man, started to beat him, and he said, look, it couldn't be me. I couldn't see. If he hadn't seen for us, we never could have done this. So the king picked up the lame man, put him on the shoulders of the blind man, and beat them together. And the deep message here, of course, is that life is lived as a conjunction between the Shama and God, body and soul. And therefore, eternity must represent the conjunction again of unification of body and soul. And the point of being a Jew is not to have a holy mind. The point of being a Jew is to have a holy body. Okay, I'm going to stop there.